Well, I guess we'll start. So we were actually hoping that sort of after maybe some opening remarks in particular that we can open this up to conversation and to dialogue in particular. I want to thank Commissioner Shiprock for that introduction. My name is Talia Gonzalez. I'm down in Los Angeles at Occidental College, but also as a visiting scholar at UCLA Law. I've actually been working in the area of juvenile justice since 2001 in those three different roles. So first as a lawyer representing students in both school expulsion cases as well as delinquency cases related to school-based arrests, and as a community organizer both in South Los Angeles and in Southside Chicago, where we see a lot of prevalence of the use of punitive discipline and zero tolerance, which has been sort of the focus, I think, in thinking about moving to restorative justice, and then now as an academic researcher. So I've been with Denver Public Schools looking at implementation of restorative justice since 2008. And what we're really excited about is that from the beginning of restorative justice in Denver to now, we have a 7-year implementation study. And so it'll be the first time that a U.S.-based program has been tracked this long and really considering those positive impacts. But I want us to step back a little bit, and I was asked to frame both restorative justice and punitive discipline, because I think that we want to reorient ourselves both to what Professor Walker was talking about in establishing norms and accountability, but really why we're in this world that we're thinking about now in terms of restorative justice. And so that really stems from the early 80s. So in the early 80s, we see, you know, tough-on-crime laws being passed. We see drug policies being passed that were all based on punitive discipline and zero tolerance. And ultimately, then that trickled into our schools, or perhaps was a tidal wave into our schools, quite frankly, in the early 90s. And with that, we saw discipline code policies adopting that same language with the hope of having that deterrent effect, but also really based on, I would say, sort of false theories about broken windows and sort of youth, and in particular youth of color in urban environments, and how we should be treating those youth in particular and removing them from the school community, removing them from the place where I think Dr. Walker really hit on something key, which is the place where we establish norms. Positive norms, positive school environments, we create that accountability and we allow to have those sparks, right? Those moments, right, where kids start to reorient themselves to thinking about that positive environment. And there was actually a report that was published last year by the Advancement Project that tracked from 1987 to 2007 the use of punitive discipline across the nation, and it led to a tripling of our prison population. So when I talk about punitive discipline and when I talk about zero tolerance, I'm very much talking about in the context of the school-to-prison pipeline. It is not a stagecoach. It is the bullet train, quite frankly. We are at a time where if schools don't start to move away from the use of punitive discipline, we will continue to see generations of our youth simply not being a part of our participatory democracy, but more importantly, just not being part of our society. And that has a lot of impacts as we sort of think far-reaching. So punitive discipline, what is it marked by? It's marked by a reliance on removing kids from schools. We see tickets being issued for things like disruption, or one of my favorite phrases out of the city of Baltimore was disrespect, insubordination, or disruption, any of those three. And actually in 2009, 33% of the students who were suspended were for one of those three things. And in the state of Colorado, you can actually have a 3 strikes against you where if you are tagged, right, you are marked within your disciplinary record as being disruptive 3 times, you can be permanently expelled from the district and sort of go through that process. And it's a law that is still on the books, and it's a law that's still used. And it's certainly not the only state that uses those types of laws. And if people are interested in that sort of level of disaggregated data, there's plenty of reports. There's 2 of the articles that I've published about this, I think, in your DVD, and we can chat about it a little bit later. With punitive discipline, we've also seen the increase of police officers on school campuses or the creation of entire police school forces. So in Los Angeles, for example, where I live, the LA Unified School District has its own school police force that is larger than the police force here in Portland. And so you have to imagine now that this is the environment, this is the norm, right, that kids are being exposed to in terms of punitive discipline, in terms of that pre-prison condition, and what they're experiencing. And that's really important when we think about adolescent development, brain development, and how kids are orienting themselves within disruptive behavior or, quite frankly, trying to survive those conditions and really being pushed out. But I think most importantly, and a lot of what my work has focused on in particular, is the disproportionate impact on kids of color. And I think that we'll look at that in the Denver example, and we'll think about that in the Park Rose example in terms of students that are now using the restorative justice programs and projects, is that discipline policies that are punitive are disproportionately impacting our kids of color. And so this really is, I would argue, both a civil rights and a human rights crisis at this point in our country that we have to think about in a little bit more critical way. And if you're thinking about policy changes at that state level, or even more importantly at the national level, it's one of the places that we could see changes in our education code. You can see changes in state constitutions where education is now being listed as a fundamental right, for example. Or this year and last year, there were two House resolutions, one about the use of restorative justice in schools and the other about push out. So again, sort of a reframing of this context to think about how we treat our kids and in particular how our educational system is structured. And so zero tolerance and punitive discipline really does two things. One, it pushes kids out of the system, right? We're removing kids from the social environment that is critical for them. They're losing credits, right? They're falling behind in courses. It's time away from their peers. There was a 2009 Oregon ACLU report that actually tracked the use of zero tolerance and punitive discipline across the state of Oregon and the criminalization of youth and showed how dropout rates were increasing. And so I encourage all of you to sort of look at that report and consider some of that data. But again, you know, I think that what is important is that the idea of using punitive discipline and zero tolerance was to keep our schools safe. And that's just not true, right? We are not creating safer school environments by removing kids through punitive discipline, through zero tolerance. And in fact, in 2006 and in 2008, we have the American Psychological Association doing long-term evidentiary review, longitudinal studies that showed exactly the opposite, that it was actually making schools less safe. And then coupling that with this police-like environment, we're really putting our youth at risk. And so it's really nice, right, to hear about both case study examples, I think, as we're talking about, but also just research that suggests that it's that reintegrative process, it's the restorative process, it's the responsive behavioral systems that really are the ones that lead to increased school safety, that lead to schools and students being in a place where now you have increased attendance, you're dealing with issues of tardiness, and that those best policies are focused in that way. The other thing that's significant about zero tolerance and punitive discipline is the intersection that we see around status offenses. So depending on the how status offenses are classified in a given state, and again, a status offense being something that you can only commit if you're a juvenile, right? Not going to school, right? Being truant. That if we reclassify some of those or we pass new codes or new policies, it allows for many status offenses which were resulting in immediate expulsion or immediate suspension to not fall into that category. And that's certainly the case in LA. You look at some of the highest rates of suspension and expulsion in schools like Roosevelt High School, which is in Boyle Heights, a historically Latino neighborhood, it is truancy tickets that are pushing those kids out faster than anything else, and for two reasons. One, because the police will sit outside school and wait for kids to be coming to school and then pick them up and give them a $500 ticket. And then when you can't pay that ticket, then a bench warrant goes out for you or for your parents. Because the assumption is that your parents should be paying for it, since you are not 18 at that point and you can't pay for it. So, you know, if we reevaluate those types of policies and we remove some of those legal connections between schools and status offenses, and in particular something like truancy, we can see a little bit better how we can have true prevention and have true intervention. And what was interesting, too, I think, in Professor Walker's talk is there was a little bit of an allusion to positive behavior support and positive behavior intervention support. I'm just going to talk about restorative justice today, but I think both of those are part of this spectrum of intervention and prevention. And so by no means do I want to leave anyone in the audience thinking that those are not absolute and essential tools and strategies in ways that we can think about reorienting what we're doing on an educational policy level. So the first restorative justice program or project or sort of moment occurred in 1990 in Australia, to give sort of a little context here. And it was a result of violence after a school dance. And it ended up being actually a whole school restorative justice because most of the school was involved. And since that time, it has absolutely been the educational policy within the international community. So Professor Walker talked about how studies have been done in terms of adolescent behavior outside of the U.S. Well, the U.S. has really lagged behind in the use of restorative justice because all of those other countries, Australia, New Zealand, Wales, Canada, the U.K., have been implementing restorative justice since the early 90s and have really produced probably some of the most significant work in terms of implementation. We don't have that same record here in the United States, but what we see with some of our early pilot studies in sort of 2001, 2002, and 2003, the beginning of that possibility. It's been used to address violence and safety, right? So again, reorienting ourselves away from punitive discipline. It's been used to address tardies, truancy, to address school performance. And that's something that I think is important because it's the moment, we heard the vignette of the teacher, right, who's having that experience with the student and that confrontation. It's the moment that actually, instead of just simply removing that student from the classroom and from that environment, as much as you'd like to do, and as a former junior high school teacher, I'm sure I was guilty of myself at certain points, it's actually now doing an RJ with that student. So having a restorative justice conference with that student, either formally or informally, so that you maintain that classroom control, you establish accountability with the student for that disruptive behavior, and you set a norm within your classroom for subsequent students to think about and really orient themselves around. And you're working towards creating a school community. And I think that that becomes the important part. And so, you know, while here in the U.S. we haven't necessarily done as much data and as much tracking, I think we've been able to see that there's been some case studies that come forward about restorative justice. And before I talk about some of those case studies, I want to make sure that we understand that restorative justice is not one size fits all. It is not something that you can simply lift and implement in 6 months, and I think we will probably hear that echoed again, right? It's something that requires really about 3 to 5 years of implementation. So on a policy side, there absolutely has to be funding mechanisms that exist for that minimum of 3 to 5 years. The most recent article that is in this DVD and that I wrote, 3 of the case studies in Santa Fe, in Philadelphia, and Virginia that I included in there, those programs no longer exist because they lost their funding this summer. So the positive results that you see reported in there unfortunately won't be continuing in the context of some of that work. You know, there are things that have been lifted from the criminal justice system and now placed into school-based restorative justice practice that some of you might be familiar with. Things like victim-offender mediation, right? That sort of one-on-one moment where you are using the mediation with a trained mediator between the victim and the offender. Family and group conferencing, right? And so again, thinking about how we use that now within a school community and sometimes replacing or including, right, both parents, but then the school community and representatives of the school community in that conferencing. Effective statements, right? So students using effective statements in that context, circling, both large and small circling, inside and outside of the classroom. But I think what's important and what's been interesting about doing the work in Denver on the qualitative side is the informal use of restorative justice. And to me, that's the prevention moment, right? RJ can be used when you have an incident in the classroom. You have a kid that brings a knife to school. There's a fight, right? All of these classic things that we see as potentially disruptive behavior or things that within the context of a discipline code require being addressed. But what happens with the kid that doesn't get in a fight because the two kids who were going to fight decide to do an RJ? That's what's really interesting, and that's what's happened in Denver now. So after 3 years of implementation, in particular at North High School, you now have a group of students, well, they've now graduated, but at the time I was interviewing them, they had been introduced to RJ as freshmen. By the time they were juniors, they were RJing themselves, which is kind of an interesting process to watch. But they were then going to the RJ coordinator when they knew something serious was going to happen to do a conference and to quash whatever they needed to quash at that time. And to think about North High School, to paint a vivid picture for yourself, North High School is located on the northeast side of Denver. It's a traditionally Latino neighborhood. It's actually controlled neighborhood-wise by three different competing gangs. These are kids that are heavily involved in gangs. These are kids who have been involved with the system in other ways. But when they get to school, because they've been oriented around the idea of their school community being the one place that is safe, the one place that they can be engaged academically, the one place that they can do well, then they're not willing to harm that environment anymore. And it didn't happen overnight, absolutely not. But it's really interesting to interview kids who at this point are saying, well, yeah, you got to quash it. You got to deal with it, right? We can't have this. We can't have violence in our school, right? I can't deal with that. In probably more colorful terms than I'm using at this moment. I think that's the power, right, of any of these strategies, and again, in that long-term investment is both on the prevention side, but on the intervention side in that context. So we have a really interesting continuum of practice, and I think this is true of the Park Rose experience as well, and has certainly been true of the Denver experience, as well as some of the work that I've been doing in Oakland and in San Francisco, is that you have this moment where, depending on what fits either within a classroom or outside of a classroom, then you utilize those tools. I think something that is important, though, about implementation is that you have to make sure that you have really strong, trained professionals in those positions, right? And that they are there in a full-time capacity. And I would actually argue that one of the things that distinguishes Denver is that there was a concerted effort to make sure that those are actually members of the school community and Denver Public School officials, as opposed to outside contractors or subcontractors from organizations, because it means that the students are building trust with the restorative justice coordinator or mediator. They're seeing that person on a day-to-day basis. I would argue, too, that issues like gender and race and language is a critical component, right? You cannot simply drop a someone who does restorative justice into a neighborhood where they are the outsider because they've never been to that neighborhood, they don't live in that neighborhood, they're afraid to park in that neighborhood, and the kids know that, right? They pick up on that instantaneously, that you cannot build that trust. So that's been a really, I think, difficult moment for implementation in some districts because the traditional restorative justice community does not look like the community that they need to serve. And so that's been something that I think many of us have really been pushing forward, is that cultural accountability in recognizing that for something like restorative justice to work, we have to build in those elements. But again, getting back to that sort of 3 to 5 year time frame, you know, we see 5 things that need to happen, right? You have to have buy-in from wonderful people like this, right? You have to have buy-in from key officials, right? And the literature talks about it in terms of like the political elites, right? The school elites. But you have to have a principal who wants this to happen. You have to have a school resource officer who is willing to hold a ticket or tickets so that you can have an RJ happen, right? You have to have teachers after at least the first year who are willing to take a chance and do RJs themselves, either because they've seen it work with someone else, they're getting back teaching time, or something else. So step one, you've got to have that clear buy-in. Next, you really have to establish what that institutional value is and that value statement is, and set some metrics and goals. Right, so it simply can't just be, well, we like RJ, and we don't like pushing kids out at disproportionately high rates, but something that has metrics for monitoring and things that are built into that. And that's actually been a challenge in PBS and PBIS schools, that there hasn't been a lot of the monitoring that's been built in on the school side. It's been outside monitoring, usually by parents. You need to have a practice that you initially establish. Is it a conferencing model? Is it group conferencing? Is it circles? What does that model look like so that it becomes oriented within the context of the whole school community? And then I actually would say this is the most significant part, and this is sometimes where I've faced a lot of the resistance, is that you need to have a district policy, your discipline code policy, that orients itself clearly in its text, in its language. Yes, the lawyer rears, you know, their ugly head. I want the text that says RJ is an option. Right, because it means now that your SROs and your disciplinarians and your vice principals and your teachers can choose to use restorative justice instead of punitive discipline. I don't want anyone to think that I'm saying that punitive discipline doesn't have a place. It absolutely does, but you should have both of those, and you need to have that policy. And it wasn't actually until 2008 that we had that discipline code policy in Denver, even though it was piloted in 2003. And then lastly, it's that continued training, that's that continued support, right, where you're reorienting yourselves within your school community. And there's a couple case studies in the most recent article that I want to point out, because this implementation doesn't have to flow in those five steps. So in Oakland, it was actually the school principal and the school disciplinarian that decided to pilot restorative justice without buy-in from the district, and did this all on their own and found outside funding and wrote a grant and worked with some local folks in the community, including parents, and implemented RJ. They had such positive results that ultimately the Oakland School Board passed a new discipline code policy and a resolution with respect to restorative justice. The opposite was true in San Francisco. San Francisco, and you know, maybe this makes sense, it's the East Bay as opposed to the city, San Francisco started with the lofty goal of having a restorative-based community and school culture, and they've now started going through the process of implementation. We see in Michigan sort of both models happening. They had an initial pilot in 2003 of four schools that was funded by a United Way grant, right? It wasn't funded by the district. They went for outside money. They oriented themselves toward restorative justice. And then once the district realized that they were getting such positive results in the context of the schools, they went from 4 to 19. And it was really interesting. I just got this data from them when I was writing the article this summer, that since the creation of the program, they have avoided 1,600 days of suspension. That is 1,600 days of kids being in the classroom, right? That's huge, right? That's a really big number. And so you can see what that means in terms of students being able to now engage not only in that normative positive environment, but more importantly be thinking about that in the level of being able to really engage in their academic experience. And so I want to briefly talk about Denver and sort of throw some facts and thoughts out there, but then really turn it over to my colleague to talk about Park Rose in particular, and then open it up to questions, because I think sometimes the questions are the most interesting part. And I apologize, I do have to look at numbers a little bit more. I cannot memorize numbers in the same way. I do lawyer math still, and I will always do lawyer math. So in Denver, we see the program developing in 2003, and it's marked by three models. First, by a pilot phase, which was at Cole Middle School. It was the middle school that had the highest number of suspensions and expulsions in the district. And then, based on positive results of that, and more importantly, by collective action by parents, which is why I included the parent organizing article from last year, we see that Cole is the site that's chosen, and the parents that worked with the organizing group, Padres y Jóvenes Unidos, were actually the ones who helped lead then the after-school mediations. So we have the first phase, 2003, one school. The district says, wow, this is kind of working, and in a really hard school. So in 2006, they apply for an EARS grant, which is an expelled and at-risk student grant from the Colorado Department of Education, and they receive a grant that has a sunset, but it's a four-year-long grant. So they're able to sort of think about implementation in that way. And at that point, they choose the site that I've been working at and will continue to work at, North High School, and three of its feeder middle schools. Going back to thinking about the critical moment, both in adolescent brain development around that age of students in middle school, but also really what middle schools represent in the entire educational spectrum. And so then we see North being selected, the three feeder schools being selected again because of high rates of suspension and high rates of expulsion. And so this is where I'll sort of point to a number, right? We see in 2001, the school year 2001 to the school year of 2005, a jump from North and those three feeder schools from 9,800 out-of-school suspensions to almost 13,500, right? So 13,487 out-of-school suspensions among four schools. And it really was for things like obscenities, disruptive appearance, shoving matches. 68% of the tickets that were being issued by the SROs were for that. So it was really egregious numbers that really caused the district to think about it. And getting to my earlier sort of point about the disproportionality, we see of those tickets in that year, 70% of those tickets were issued to Latino students, whereas they're only 58% of the overall student population. 35% of all expulsions were with African American students, even though they're only 19% of the population across the entire district and in those schools. And so at that point, you know, we see the implementation in the four schools, and it starts going really well. And ultimately then you see adding in six more sites across the district because the district decided it was going to adopt this across the entire district instead of just at its sort of most high-risk schools in that context. And so now it's in the elementary schools as well as in the middle schools as well as in the high schools. So in the first year, we had 213 students who went through the RJ program, and we see a reduction of 29% of suspensions, so going from just at one school where you had 1,100 down to 835. And by no means do I want to pretend like 835 is a good number, right? But we're doing something, right? It's starting to decrease. And then the next year, we have 812 students who go through the process, and we see a reduction at Skinner and at Horace Mann of all expulsions. There were no expulsions that year. And that was because the expulsions were, they did RJs in lieu of the expulsions. And so with the expansion of the program, we're able now to start tracking things like office referrals, tardiness, students improving in terms of dropping out and other areas. So in 07 and 08, there's an 87% reduction among students who participate in RJs in office referrals in the first semester. In the second semester, that jumps to 92%. So kids who are going through the RJ process are now decreasing the office referrals overall that they have in that context. We see then improvements in tardiness and in attendance. We have 13% of the students who go through RJ who have improved their tardiness by 57% in the first semester. They're showing up, right? Which is great and really exciting to think about. They're coming to school. They want to be at school. It's about that creating that school community. And I know that oftentimes we focus on things like the end result, the school-to-prison pipeline, the funding issues, but I don't want us to forget it's about the school community and it's about creating that whole school environment. This past year, the district asked me and others to do qualitative interviewing with 293 students. So I got to get some skiing in and do interviews, so that was kind of nice. My partner was not as thrilled because he didn't get to spend the time skiing as much as I did. But what I looked at was students who had engaged in at least three restorative justice interventions over the course of 2 years and was looking at social skills and grades. And so what we found was there was a 30% decrease in failing grades in the first semester. In the second semester, that was actually at 50%. Students who were engaging at least two RJs, we see a 64% reduction in the number of period absences, and then tardiness also improved by 47%. So it was really significant across almost 300 students who'd been involved in the program and within their different school sites, and not just one school site now, to see those same type of results. And then in 2008, both, I would say, two things. One, the district recognized that they needed to have policies in place, because while you had certain schools where the principal was on board, the SRO was on board, the disciplinarian was on board, the teacher was on board, there were other schools who were very resistant to it because there wasn't a discipline code policy that mandated it. And then you also had organizing groups like Padres and outside folks like the Advancement Project being very critical of their discipline code policy. We see the revision of the discipline code policy in 2008. And that's the phase that we're in now, because it's also the phase where we've had the sunsetting of the EARS grant. And what's happened is that individual schools have actually picked up the funding for it. And that's something where principals have made the commitment to figure out the mechanisms to fund this within their given schools. And I'm not talking about schools in Walnut Creek, if you're familiar with Denver, right? I'm talking about schools in the Denver Unified School District or right outside Denver Unified School District like Lincoln and others. And so I could talk about Denver forever. It's wonderful. It's great. I love it. It's a huge part of what my life is right now. The 7-year study will get written this summer because I have some time off. And so we're really looking forward to what that means, because we're able to now show implementation across 7 years at multiple sites and what the results have been, not just on the quantitative side, but what's really important to me is the qualitative side. Every single interview I've done with a teacher, every single interview I've done with a student, every single interview I've done with a parent, and what that's meant in terms of transforming the educational experience of some of the most at-risk kids in Denver. But arguably, what that's now meant is this work has moved beyond Denver into places like Chicago and Oakland, where I find myself spending more and more time because there's been such a concerted effort to focus that way. So I know I'm totally over time, and I apologize. That's where I'll say I'm still an academic, right? And I just can't stop talking. So I'll stop talking.
Well, it's very, very nice to be here with all of you today, and especially wonderful to be able to sit next to someone who can obviously tell you that people are making a difference in the lives of children. It's also exciting to be able to share a positive, best, promising practice with you all, because we hear so much about the problems in schools today. But it's not that often that we get to talk about some of the things that are working well and hopefully would have an influence on how we spend our money in the future. So just a little bit of Multnomah County history that kind of brings us to where we are today. In 2008 to 2011, a group through the Multnomah County Education and Life Success Work Group did a 3-year study on the disproportionality in discipline of students of color across Multnomah County to prove our point that we knew that that was currently happening in our school districts. And the report, which is in draft form now, will be available to you next month. And what that does is it just proves that it is true that all across our school districts, not only the 6 school districts that touch the city of Portland, but all of our school districts have a proven case of disproportionality in discipline and exclusion of students of color. So that brought us in Park Rose School District, and for those of you that don't know us, Park Rose is located just east of Portland Public Schools. No, we are not Portland Public Schools, but we are 100% in the city of Portland, as is David Douglas School District, also to the east. And we have 3,500 students and have had a very flat enrollment in our school district over the last 10 to 15 years. So that's been pretty steady. So we wrote a grant to be able to start work in restorative justice, and I had never heard of it before. But I had two wonderful principals, Ana Gonzalez at our high school and Molly Davis, Davies at our middle school, who clearly saw that this partnership was going to help our kids. The partnership in Park Rose now is paid for half of City of Portland, half of Multnomah County, and they have continued to support this work over the last 3 years, and we have 3 years of data to share with you. The partnership is with Park Rose School District, Juvenile Justice, Northwest Resolutions, who provides our counselor, and Portland Police Bureau through our SRO program, and that partnership is what makes it work. So just a little bit of data for you. I don't want to give you too much, but the numbers are significant. And the other part about this is that the numbers are local. And so they show you that it can be done if it's done the right way. So in year one of restorative justice, this included the middle school and the high school. The middle school has a student population of about 850. And the high school of about 1,050. We held 152 restorative justice meetings, and 92% of the meetings ended in agreement. 95% of the successful cases were closed in 90 days with no breach of agreement. And that means that they came to an agreement and the agreement was followed through. 89% of the participants reported satisfaction with the process. And this would range anywhere from somebody who vandalized something in the neighborhood, to somebody hit somebody, to somebody was about to hit somebody, somebody stole somebody else's boyfriend. There are just all kinds of reasons that would cause us to go to a conference. And just as an aside to you, the Restorative Justice Conference now is on our referral pages. So it is now inculcated and part of the culture of the way we do discipline in Park Rose School District. It's right on the page. So a teacher can check off, yeah, we're going to go to restorative justice in this case. In 2009 and 2010, the statistics are even better as we got better at this process. And our teachers also bought into the restorative justice process. They saw how it worked. The community touted it as a best practice. And so it started to get even more embraced. Excuse me. We had 401 students referred to the program and 347 who participated. 210 cases were opened by Resolutions Northwest. 89% of the meetings came to an agreement, and 97% of those were successfully closed. And here's the great part. Out of these conferences, 104 days of suspension were avoided, 6 days of in-school suspension avoided, 3 juvenile justice cases avoided, 1 police report avoided, and $122.80 in restoration paid. So we start to see that this program is really doing something to keep kids in school. What is our goal? Keeping kids in school. Because why? Because school is the best place for kids, and that's what we want. In the third year of the program, which was last year, and of course we're collecting data this year as well, 364 students were referred to the program, 334 students participated, 93% of the cases met, 76% ended in agreement, with 96% of the successful cases closed in 90 days with no breach of agreement. That means what they said they would do, they did. Last year, 158 days of suspension for Park Rose were avoided. That is one little school district avoided. 36 days of in-school suspension was avoided. One juvenile justice case, four police reports avoided, and $287.40 in restoration paid. So as you can see, over the time that we are being able to put this into practice, the practice is getting better for kids, better for the community, bringing our kids and families back to peace in the community. So a couple of statistics on student demographics, because this is where the disproportionality is seen. In 2009 and 2010, the students that participated in the program were 38% white. Now, our school district is about 38% white, so that one kind of fit. But 29% of participants were African American, and our school district is 17% African American, so that number is disproportionate, almost double. 1% Native American, which matches the district, 2% Asian, that's low for the district. 3% Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander, that's about right. 21% Hispanic is about right, and 6% multiracial. Last year, the student demographics were 39% white, which once again kind of fits our demographic, but the unfortunate trend in Park Rose School District, and I'll call it out, is that 35% of the participants were African American, which is now even higher disproportionality to our school district, which makes us unhappy. 1% Native American, 2% Asian, again, 0% Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander, 10% Hispanic, which is a positive trend as far as little bitty trends go, and 11% who report as multiracial. So we know that across the board we have a lot of work to do. So the closing remarks that I would make, and then I really, with Talia, would kind of hope that people could ask us questions about how this works, not only in a national way, in a research way, and a way in other case studies, but in a Portland, City of Portland model that has a full-time counselor working in our school. That person is there. It's the same guy. It hasn't changed. His name is Daniel Garcia. He does a fabulous job. He's a wonderfully trained person. The kids trust him. They love him. We also have had great relationships with our school resource officer. Our original officer that started this program, Bob Tallman, is no longer with the police bureau, but he was right there trying to keep kids in school. So the attitude has been there. The principals are phenomenal. The teachers are phenomenal, and so is the community. And our board has embraced this in policy as well. So all of the different pieces that Talia talked about, without even knowing them, that's what the district has done, because those are the things that support this work. So here's what I would close with, and this is just my little superintendent advice. The key is keeping kids in school. We all know that the best place for kids is in school. The second you start suspending a child is the time they start losing credit. And when they start losing credit because they lost out in school, they now don't know what's going on in algebra. They will begin to feel hopeless, and they will start acting out, dropping out, taking drugs, taking alcohol, going wherever they can to feel good, and they're not going to be in school for very long. So we must at all cost, except where the law prohibits, because there are certain things we have to deal with, we need to keep kids in school. The other key is culturally responsive teaching practice. We have a lot of teachers who have been teaching in our schools, a lot in my district I'll speak to, for a long time, and the demographics in our district have changed, and they haven't. And so you are not looking at culture as being one of the key drivers of education when you say that I'm colorblind. That is the worst thing you can do, in my opinion. Culture fits in school, and we have to address that. All of the school districts, almost without exception in Multnomah County, are doing work in what the University of Washington, Seattle, and the work of Geneva Gay and James Banks talk about is culturally responsive teaching, courageous conversations, bringing this awareness to the fore. If we don't do this in a better way, we aren't going to get anywhere, in my opinion. We can get a little ways, but we're not going to get where we need to get if we don't address this full on and openly. And so we are working on that with staff training and mostly awareness. And then finally is put your money here. If anybody's got any money, put your money here. Because restorative justice works. It works if you work it and you keep it to fidelity and you implement it with fidelity. It works. It's like turning on a light switch. So I just hope that when legislators and policymakers are thinking about what they want to fund, rather than talking about prison beds, let's put the money in the kids. Because I can't control what goes on at home with them, but I can tell you at school, this is a process that works.
I don't know your name, so I can't call on you, right? But are there questions from anyone? I think there's two mics that appear, or you can just project.
Okay. Possible. So there are two mics, and then I'm going to go around with a traveling mic if I can find it. Or you can just shout it out.
Oh, I see you want to play. And please come up to the mic. Oh.
Dr. Gray, would you talk about the interface between PBS at Park Rose and RJ?
I can say this. There is a current push with Multnomah County to push restorative justice out as a promising practice to all school districts in Multnomah County. One thing that's happened this year is it has gone to Riegler Elementary School in Portland Public Schools and to David Douglas School District. I will say that the model is different because the funding is very slim. And what's happened is it's been a trainer of trainers model where a person at the school has been trained in restorative justice methodology. What it doesn't have is the person who is assigned to the school. Now, it's experimental as a different model this year, and we hope to be able to have a forum in the county regarding restorative justice in the spring to talk about best practice and how it's working. So I do know that that has been an experiment this year in Portland Public Schools and at David Douglas School District using a slightly different model. And we're going to continue talking about that because the ELS group, which unfortunately now is no longer, did include school districts from all across the county, of which several people are in the audience.
I would actually say in Chicago you have the use of PBS and the use of RJ in schools, so by no means are they mutually exclusive.
We use them together.
Yeah, and in fact, most people would argue that they're part of the same spectrum of a continuum in addressing issues.
Yeah, and I certainly don't see them as mutually exclusive.
In fact, I would think
they would need to work together. And I just wondered if Park Rose, I was understanding that Park Rose was implementing PBS as well, and I was wondering how that interface looked, or if you can comment.
Well, because, you know, you could go on and on about PBIS, and we have the, experts sitting in the audience there. But Park Rose and the district I worked 17 years in previous to Park Rose, Coos Bay School District, was full on K-12 PBIS. But PBIS also fits into RTI, which is really the big umbrella. So that's the response to instruction. Some people call it response to intervention. We call it response to instruction. So it is part of a broader system, but PBIS is a best practice. Absolutely part of the school district. This is a program that also uses PBIS standards for school-wide behavior. Within our conversation for restorative justice, they work hand in hand.
I'm sorry.
That is positive behavior intervention.
Thank you. If you could expand the acronyms. You
yes,
missed,
sorry.
You missed the part this morning where we imposed a fine on it. No. We,
good luck collecting.
PBIS is...
Positive behavior. I've heard it instruction support, intervention support. PBIS used to be EBIS, used to be EBS. Is now EBIS in some school districts.
Other.
It's school-wide.
I have a question, and I'm familiar with the teacher training by Geneva Gay, or what have you, the Black Parent Initiative program at Concordia, have brought her in. One of the things I want, plus some of the conferences that they have at Park Rose on the, the larger spectrum.
Yes.
I'm not a teacher. But I am a community member, and my special focus basically is dealing with kids' behavior, especially cause and effect. From personal experience and being involved in, which is now considered as RISE, used to be the Oregon, so statewide program, teaching parents how to deal with the public schools. Regarding their kids having IEPs or some type of mental disability or what have you. And one of the things from experience noticing is that a lot of people from school district was not there that should be there. And because of having a family member, what have you, is one of the reasons I got on board in order to help build my foundation under developmental psych. Now, how are you guys handling that? And implementing that, because we know that school administrators basically hold the key as to where, even to this day, I have a 17-year-old nephew from the time he was little tot or what have you, with a disability or what have you. My sister has spent more time dealing and educating them about the disability, and they're just saying, oh, he meet benchmarks. Or what have you. Well, he was diagnosed with Asperger's not too long ago. But this has been a constant battle. What are you guys doing as far as training, implementing? Because I find that most administrators in some of these schools know nothing about IEP.
Oh my.
You know, even to write one up. That is federally funded. And every child is entitled to that if they need assistance. The 504 plan and what have you. But that has been one of the constant, you know, barriers. What are you guys doing to bring your teachers up to par, which it starts with the principal on down? And usually that's who you're battling.
Wow. So that is a really big question. Let me think about how to answer that question. Also disproportionate. Yeah. Well, one thing that I know is required when you get your licensure as a teacher and especially as an administrator is there are certain standards for that licensure. You have to take courses on students with different abilities. So you have to do that. Any teacher who is a special educator, and I taught special ed for 20 years at the high school level before I became an administrator, so I know that intimately, and was a special ed director in two different districts, you have to know how to write an IEP and talk about it in a really intelligent manner. But you also added in the whole idea about culture around special education identification. It's where I think you're going, and maybe parent training. We also have a disproportionate amount of students of color eligible in different special education eligibility categories as well. And let me tell you, districts get in big trouble for that. And that's monitored on an annual basis, and if you as a school district have that and you don't have a darn good reason, which most of us don't, you have to rectify that. So that doesn't just go under the carpet. But you also talked about parents, and I would just say this. Two things you mentioned is there's the Black Parent Initiative. I don't know if you guys know what that is, but Charles McGee and his group have a program called the Black Parent Initiative, and they have the Parent Academy. And Park Rose and David Douglas just wrote a grant to have the Parent Academy available to our African-American parents. And this is a very complicated subject, and I'm not going to get into it because there's not the time or energy. But there are multiple parent academies available to parents that are African-American, taught by African-Americans, about parenting students and navigating the school district. So that is available. Unfortunately or unfortunately, it costs money, but we did write a grant, and we just got that grant, and we will be doing that this year. Also, there's Community and Parents for Public Schools, CPPS. That's a national organization, and that's the Park Rose events we've been having. That incorporated over 500 parents in the area, multiple languages. I think we had over 30 languages, talking to parents about how to navigate the school system, including special education, housing, food bank, health insurance, the arts. It's a huge event, and it happens every October. So I think if parents have a complaint about the way that their child is being treated or the services they're getting, their first call is to go to the principal. They need to have a conversation. I don't even know if I answered your question. Yes. It's really hard to deal with when people don't ask, because it's hard for us to ferret out who knows what.
Because a lot of these workshops are free.
Yes. And CPPS is a free event, and it's wonderful. That's an example of how we can educate parents if they will come to it. Thank you. Good questions. What else, you guys, can you think of?
We can always sit down.
Yeah.
Just there, not here.
I just had a question about what you, Dr. Gray, you mentioned about the school resource officer being a participant in your restorative justice program. And I was really glad to hear that. I want to find out a little bit more of how the resource officer and how the police bureau has been participating in that process in a positive way.
Yes. And by the way, Suzanne and Judge Maurer and Mary Margaret and Matt, they all helped us to do the brochures. I just wanted to say that and give a plug to my homies there, because we were a crew doing this work. And I hope I didn't miss anyone else. What else? So you asked the question about how the Portland Police Bureau, I don't know if it's luck or what, but we have had excellent school resource officers. And because the school district has embraced restorative justice as a model and it's become part of our culture, for them, when they step in, that's what they see. So they become a part of it by coming in. And I think that there is special training that the SROs have to go through. We've been lucky to get, this is not disparaging or meant to be, but a lot of really young people. And they have just been on board with not only trying to keep the SRO program alive in our schools for what they can do for educational purposes. We involve them as part of our faculty. They get to be part of our celebrations. They participate in professional development. We embrace them as school district people. And so I think because of that, we're all in it together. And maybe because no one's opposed anything that we've done, we feel like that's support. And it's just worked out really, really well. This program would not work if the SROs were not willing to set aside, as you said, to put on hold a ticket, to say, no, we've defined some things that we are not going to turn them in about, because we know that the second that happens, the pipeline starts. That's where the pipeline starts to the prison. And so we want to avoid that at all cost. And so far, without breaking any rules, the police have really been helpful, and we couldn't do it without them.
How did you overcome, or maybe you didn't experience this, any political or parental community who maybe wouldn't have been receptive to this, who maybe saw their kids as the good kids and who would have demanded, you know, get these kids out, I don't want them in school with my kids? And how did you overcome those kind of resistance from that other kind of parent community?
I feel like I'm hogging all of the questions.
That's because you're in Portland. See, if I was in Colorado, everyone would
know. But anyway, I want to say that some of the answer to that, that's a really good question, because that's the other side of it, that there are times where people don't want to participate or just want the kids punished. And in fact, they'll call us and say, what'd you do to them? Okay, you suspended my kid, or you did this with my kid. What'd you do with the other ones? Mm-hmm. And that happens all the time. Because of the fact that there is such ownership in the principals of the building, the assistant principals in the building, and the counselor in the building, they go a long way to describe to parents why we are doing this. They spend the time to describe the process, where it comes from, why, how it's worked, why it's a better thing to do. For the most part, we really can't force people to do this. I cannot force parents to show up to the meetings, and we have had parents that have not shown up to the meetings, and I told you that in my statistics. It wasn't 100%, was it? But we go a long way to describe to people why we think it's better for the community of Park Rose to have a discussion and to build a bridge for children and families as a way back to relationships in school than to destroy that bridge by punishment and expulsion. I guess the final analysis is those that get it, and those that don't, don't. We just have to keep educating everyone we can possibly find about why this works.
And I would say that's, you know, something that's been important both in Denver but also in Los Angeles, is that, you know, this isn't something that's just simply happening in the school, right? So you have parent organizers or parents in the local community who were engaged in the process of seeing how the pilot program happened at Cole, right? And so the word of mouth is obviously very powerful. But in L.A., and especially in District 7 in South Los Angeles, it's been through an orientation of thinking about education as a human right and recognizing that that is a more critical component to starting to link communities that have historically been at odds. If you think about black brown politics in Los Angeles and what that means, especially in South Central Los Angeles, it's about, you know, acknowledging that this is about parent engagement and dignity, right? You have a right to be engaged in the process, right, about discipline with your students, and that you had historically been marginalized in that process, both you as a parent now, but probably your parents and your grandparents when you were going through that process. It's about acknowledging that, you know, there has to be a fundamental right to education for all children, and that in that moment you might be seeking punishment, you might want punishment for that other child, but what happens when the shoe's on the other foot, right? And especially where we're talking about things like disruption, right, drawing on your desk. I mean, this is the level of incidents that do allow for suspension and expulsion across this country. I'm not talking about a kid who brings a gun to school, right? I'm not talking about a violent fight that results in hospitalization or threats that rise to the level that there has to be an intervention that is more along the lines of punishment, right? I'm talking about things that we simply should not be putting kids into a system that is about punishment and that trains them in many ways to become criminals in that context. So I think the reorientation towards a human rights framework as opposed to a very oppositional framework has been important, but also making sure that parents are part of that process. And that has been critical in Denver, that's been critical in Los Angeles, it's been critical in Oakland, that's been critical in Chicago. That was certainly the case in Philadelphia, as we've looked at the work in Philadelphia as well. So I think you have to have parents be part of that conversation, or you do run into more of that adversarial moment. But it's a process. And again, this is why it isn't one size fits all. It isn't about the moment where it just sort of happens and we all sit around in a peace circle, right? And we're happy and our kids are there and it's great, right? No, I mean, these are historically, these are also neighborhoods that have been marginalized in a way that people feel fundamentally disempowered. Right? And we are talking about intergenerational poverty in many of these communities where that is a critical issue, and starting to talk about that becomes the moment where you recognize your kid being in school as well as your neighbor's kid being in school is actually a really important moment, right? And so you start to see collaborative community action in a way that you had historically not been able to see because of that level of intergenerational poverty, because of historical and systemic racism in this country, and in particular as it links to the prison industrial complex. You know, just to, you know, throw
perhaps
a few things
last
out there.
Question.
I had a question. As we work into this recession we're in and the battle for money, we've each mentioned it, and we have some collaboration here in Multnomah County we've been working on. When you talked about the volume of kids that you're dealing with that are not penetrating then into the criminal justice system, is there beginning to be any cost-benefit analysis or anything that says if we took this much out of corrections and put it in the school, into this program, we at the end of the day would actually end up better off than where we currently spend the money? Are we getting that kind of cross-silo checking?
I don't know in Park Rose or in Portland if that conversation has been happening. That's obviously been happening actually across the country. So that's been happening in Denver. That analysis started, and that conversation started about 3 years ago. That's happened in California, especially because we now have a Supreme Court order that's required us to start to deinstitutionalize our prisons because of issues of Eighth Amendment violations and overcrowding. It's happened in D.C. It's happened in Philadelphia. So really, as we look nationally, that's part of the conversation, and it's why we've been able to have two House resolutions that have focused on push out and on restorative justice. And in the legislative history, it's a clear economic balance about how if we were putting this money into schools, and not just schools broadly as educational policy and sort of quick fix, but these long-term systemic changes, that we start to see that influence. Louisiana is one of the few states that's been very resistant to that, unfortunately, especially given the disproportionality that we see with young men of color, and in particularly black men of color in New Orleans and in Louisiana with rates of incarceration. But by and large, it's something that's actually really easy to cross party lines with because you're talking about economics, right? You're now talking about how you can start to balance a budget in a little bit different way. So those conversations have been going on for a number of years and continue to grow. I actually think that will probably be one of the ways that we see continued funding mechanisms is around that type of conversation, as opposed to thinking about school culture, right, and changes and shifts in that way. When you talk about the school-to-prison pipeline and what it costs to educate a student in a year and what it costs to incarcerate a youth in a year, it's pretty dramatic, and it's really hard to argue against that. And so I think that that becomes a significant piece of the puzzle.
Thank you for being a wonderful audience.
Yes, thank you so much.
Oh, okay. You had your red card up there.
Yeah, I know there's like red cards.
And we were being obedient, so.
1 minute. Yes, 1 minute. I wanted to echo on Dr. Gray's comments around the importance of a partnership with the school resource officer in this type of effort. And The Education and Life Success Work Group that recently completed the report she mentioned did a series of interviews with local school resource officers, and there are some additional challenges that are important to note when you're working in communities that don't necessarily have access or the availability of active parent involvement for any number of reasons. And so one of the interviews, we spoke with a school resource officer who had a partnership with a school, had a Walmart right across the street, and the Walmart would call the school resource officer if they had a shoplifting problem. And then the student would be released to the SRO. And the alternative is if they can't reach a parent during a day, during the day the parent is maybe not accessible or maybe doesn't have the luxury of leaving work to come down and have the student released to them, then it's a call to the police. Mm-hmm. And so it's a huge advantage to have the school resource officer involved in the community and involved in that as a resource for students and for families. And then my very last piece is that I wanted to let you know that the report will be available electronically, and we can forward a link to the conference participants. So thank you.
I'll quickly say, it's less than a minute, I promise. There's two reports about SROs that have recently been released by Harvard Law School by their work on civil rights that highlights that, but also suggests that there has to be retraining and reorientation. Mm-hmm. Because while Bob Tallman is fantastic and amazing here in Portland, and he was the school resource officer that started this work in Park Rose, or Kenneth Chavez is spectacular at North High School, there are many school resource officers who do not share the same ideology, right? And so I don't want people to be left with the idea that we can simply rely on school resource officers as they're currently trained, because many of them come in with a set ideology about punishment and about deterrence, and they aren't engaging in the same type of work. So that's a big policy consideration if you're thinking about pushing for policy change, is a retraining of officers, a reorientation of school resource officers in particular, to start to adopt this type of framework and this type of work. And it also then, again, says, how do we start to mirror our school resource officers in a way that it's the community that they're serving? Because that is not always historically the case, too, and that creates a bit of a problem. And I can see there's someone looming, so I'm going to stop talking.
I want to thank you again, Dr. Gonzalez and Dr. Gray, Thank you for being so participatory, and I have two announcements that are both exciting. One is we get to have our speakers back on a panel shortly, and the other is this time. Can someone give me a signal? I believe there really are.
I see them.
Yeah. There are cookies right there.